Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on vacation. Many people are surprised when they hear that bladder cancer is the fifth most common cancer diagnosis in the United States. It kills more than 14,000 Americans each year. Joining me in the studio to talk about its causes and new approaches to treatment, Diane Zerpasky-Qualley of the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you, Susan.
From an NPR studio in Geneva, New York, Sandra Steingraber, a biologist and bladder cancer survivor. Thank you for being with us, Sandra.
My pleasure, Susan.
And from WYPR in Baltimore, Dr. Mark Schoenberg of the Johns Hopkins Medical Institutions, who I understand has just finished some bladder cancer surgery. Doctor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, Diane, you have launched this advocacy group for bladder cancer survivors. How did you get involved with this?
Susan, my husband, John Qualley, was first diagnosed with bladder cancer in 2000, and at that time, we were really surprised. We'd never even heard of bladder cancer. We didn't know anybody else who had ever had the disease. So, of course, we went online, tried to find out what we could about the disease, and there wasn't that much information about it. And John had bladder cancer. He had metastatic invasive disease that was diagnosed in May of 2001. And so we both got more actively involved, me particularly, in the cancer advocacy community, because the diagnosis of cancer is a life-changing event for the entire family. And it was through that work we just found out that there wasn't anything out there for bladder cancer. There were no other advocacy groups, despite the fact that for every other cancer out there, there were usually more than one. So we thought it was time to make a change and do something about that.
And how did your husband's own battle with this disease go?
Well, John had had every treatment available for bladder cancer, including systemic chemotherapy, chemo radiation, immunotherapy. He had to have his bladder removed, and then he had a recurrence of metastatic disease again in November of 2007. So he went through chemotherapy again, but it was not responsive, and my husband died of bladder cancer in June of 2008.
We're so sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Schoenberg, what are the risk factors associated with bladder cancer? Who is most likely to get it?
This is a disease that for many years has been understood to be caused by chemicals that people are exposed to through a whole variety of different interactions with the environment. Clearly, many people are familiar with the fact that tobacco smoke, the smoking of cigarettes, predisposes individuals and increases their risk of developing bladder cancer. But there are other exposures, and I suspect that our other guest is going to talk a little bit about this, exposures in the environment, chemicals encountered in the workplace, possibly even contaminants in either the water supply or the food chain that may putatively contribute to an increased risk of the development of this disease.
And in fact, I was reading last night that bladder cancer was the first cancer that anyone anywhere was able to link to occupational exposure to chemicals back in 1895. Tell us about that.
Yes, there's a doctor historically very important in urology and actually in cancer epidemiology, Augustus Wren, who was an internist taking care of workers who were employed in what was then the German textile industry based outside of Frankfurt, Germany. These workers were exposed in the course of their daily occupation to chemicals that were used to produce dyes that in turn were used to color fabrics. These dyes became some of the first chemicals known to actually cause, through human exposure, the development of bladder cancers. And his book about this experience is one of the seminal contributions to early industrial hygiene.
Sandra Steingraber, you've written your own book more recently, Living Downstream, about the role that you believe environmental factors can play. Tell us about what you found.
Well, I guess that, like so many people, my own journey on this subject really began with my own diagnosis. I was diagnosed at age 20. I was a young biology major at the time. And while lying there, still exhaling anesthesia, my own urologist asked me some questions about had I ever smelted aluminum or vulcanized tires. And those were surreal questions to me at the time. But back in the university library, I began to gather string on the question of what might have caused my disease. And I learned that, in fact, bladder cancer is considered a quintessential environmental cancer. And the questions my physician asked me were the right ones. And I guess for me, what was stunning was to learn that even though we have this absolute proof, as Dr. Schoenberg said, going back to 1895, that a certain class of chemicals, and the case that he described with these textile dyes is a class of chemicals called aromatic amines, that just because we have all this knowledge doesn't mean that we ever took steps to divorce our economy from their use and dependency on these chemicals. And in fact, in 1989, a brand new aromatic amine, a pesticide called amazathepir, went on the market. And then last year in 2009, the first paper was published showing that farmers who use this aromatic amine pesticide have elevated rates of bladder cancer. So somehow all of our knowledge has not yet transformed itself into an effective campaign to prevent the disease. And I'm really hoping that the organization that Diane has founded can begin to do that for us.
Sandra Steingraber, you mentioned that you were first diagnosed with bladder cancer at age 20. How long have you lived with the disease?
Well, I'm 50 now, so I've lived with it for 30 years.
Diane, you mentioned that other diseases have organizations of activists associated with them, advocate for funding and so on, but not bladder cancer. Why do you think that is?
Well, perhaps Dr. Schoenberg can even answer that question better than I. It's something that we tried to figure out why there hadn't been anything at the time that we started looking into it. I think, Susan, a lot of it has to do with it's a disease below the belt. It's has a certain yuck factor with it, for lack of a better word. And there was nobody out there who wanted to come forward and start talking about it. As you know, 25 years ago, people weren't talking about cancer very much anyway. And it took somebody like Betty Ford to come out and say, I have breast cancer, that got that whole movement going. And it's taken people like that to come forward and talk about particular cancers. We just didn't have anybody coming forward with bladder cancer.
Sandra, did you find that too, that it was hard to get people to want to talk about it? I wonder how you felt yourself about talking about it and advocating for it.
I think it was hard. Although I was diagnosed in 1979, and I think nobody was talking about cancer then. It was really, in my memory, the AIDS movement of the 1990s that provided us a language for young people confronting a possible serious illness, that marching under that banner, silence equals death, that really opened up a critical space in our culture for all cancer survivors. But I do think there's a lot of silence around bladder cancer, so that when I wrote Living Downstream, which is really my best attempt as a biologist to summarize the link between environmental exposures and all human cancers, it's also a memoir of my own experience with bladder cancer, and I'm very descriptive about the personal experiences of that. And when that book was turned into a film, one of the things that I insisted with my filmmaker that we do was take a film crew into the procedure room to have my annual cystoscopic checkup, which is something all bladder cancer patients are on very familiar terms with, but I think the general public doesn't have an image of what a cystoscope is like we might have for a mammogram, for example. And I really wanted to pull back the curtain of secrecy by including that procedure on the film.
You know, that reminds me a little of Katie Couric's decision to have a colonoscopy on the air after her husband died of colon cancer. What kind of reaction did you get after doing that in the documentary?
Well, the documentary is just in theaters now, so it's just beginning its journey, I guess. I'll tell you the strangest and most unexpected reaction is my own, which is that I thought when I went in, you know, bringing a camera crew into a room where I've always walked by myself, taking off my clothes, putting on that backless blue cotton gown, and getting up in the stirrups, I thought I was demystifying this for the public, but it wasn't until I actually saw the rough cut of that footage that I realized that by viewing this procedure, I was demystifying it for myself. Because after all, when I'm there as a patient in real time, I'm just lying there waiting for my urologist to say, you know, everything looks normal, or there's a suspicious spot here, now we're collecting the cells for cytology and so forth. I didn't really see and hear the sort of compassion in his voice as he narrated the interior landscape of my bladder as it was up in the, displayed on the computer monitor. I didn't notice that the room in which I take my clothes off and put on the backless blue cotton gown is actually covered with posters of male genitalia, because after all, urologists have as their patient population lots of men with prostate cancer. And so I get dressed, or, you know, or in front of all these penis posters. And so it was those kind of details I actually noticed myself as a viewer of the film, and I hope other viewers will see it too. Part of my intent in doing this is to let people know, look, this really is a life-saving technology. It's way more accurate than a mammogram, for example. And no one should be fearful if they find blood in their urine, which is the usual presenting symptom of bladder cancer. No one should be fearful of a tube with a flashlight on the end of it. It really is a life-saving technique.
Sandra Steingraber, she's a biologist and the author of Living Downstream. And we're also joined this hour by Dr. Mark Schoenberg, who's the director of urologic oncology at the James Buchanan Brady Urological Institute at the Johns Hopkins Medical Institution. That's a mouthful. And with me in the studio, Diane Qualley. She's president and co-founder of the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network. When we come back, we're going to take some of your calls and questions, read some of your emails. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And joining me this hour in the studio, Diane Zapersky-Qualley, president of the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network. Joining us from Geneva, New York, Sandra Steingraber, a biologist and bladder cancer survivor. And from WYPR in Baltimore, Dr. Mark Schoenberg, who's a urologist and at Johns Hopkins Medical Institutions. Dr. Schoenberg, tell us about how you diagnosed bladder cancer and what signs people might be aware of.
Well, as Susan was saying before the break, the most common presenting symptom is blood in the urine, blood that the patient can see in the toilet after urination. That is usually painless. It is usually not associated with symptoms of, for example, a urinary tract infection, pain, burning. And the identification of blood in the urine should prompt the individual who observes this to call either the family doctor or seek out a urologic consultation, because an evaluation is required.
And if someone comes in to see you, then is it pretty easy to diagnose, or is it hard disease to diagnose?
Well, as you heard before the break, it's actually a pretty straightforward evaluation. What it requires is an evaluation of both the kidneys and the ureters, the engines of the body that make urine, and the tubes that convey the urine to the bladder. That can be done with a special type of X-ray, a CAT scan, for example. And then the bladder requires inspection as well, and that's done with a lighted telescope, as was described.
Now we
usually as an outpatient and usually not requiring anesthesia.
And what about, what kind of treatment, what's usually the treatment protocol that you follow?
Well, thankfully, most patients in the United States who are diagnosed with bladder cancer are diagnosed with a disease that is referred to as non-invasive urothelial cancer. And these tumors don't usually dig into the wall of the organ, the bladder, don't have a tendency to spread, but they do have a tendency to recur. So typically, sort of in a way that's analogous to the removal of a colon polyp during colonoscopy, bladder tumors can often be removed, usually under anesthesia, with a special type of scope that has an operating element on the end of it that permits removal and then cauterization of little blood vessels underneath the tumor to prevent bleeding subsequently.
And now I know that you've been involved in development of some new treatment options. What is on the cutting edge of this field?
Well, particularly with respect to the new innovations that are relevant to the large group of individuals who are diagnosed with bladder cancer, early detection and technologies that are less intrusive than cystoscopy have fascinated physicians and scientists in this area for a long time. So there's currently a lot of effort expended on developing what are referred to as in vitro diagnostic tests, tests that can be done on voided urine that would be able to tell the physician whether there is a high or low likelihood of cancer in the individual being tested at a particular time. So early diagnosis, better, less painful diagnosis, is a real focus for many laboratories across the country and around the world. With particular respect for into the smaller group of individuals who, as Diane Qualley was describing in the case of her husband's course, who require bladder removal, there are some new innovations, particularly related to the area of regenerative medicine, which your audience may be familiar with, namely taking cells from the body and then growing on scaffoldings, various replacement parts for pieces of the body that are removed during surgery. Well, there's now an opportunity to grow replacement parts for part of the lower urinary tract. This is being done, and I should tell you that I'm serving as a consultant to a company that does this, that is now growing replacement parts using this technology, and a clinical trial is actually opened at the University of Chicago, run by Gary Steinberg, beginning to utilize these new replacement parts for reconstruction in patients who are going to have their bladders removed to try to cure their bladder cancer. It's a very exciting time. This will take us away from a more traditional reconstructive option, which requires the use of a component of the patient's intestinal tract.
Now, Patty Hansen, the former supermodel married to Keith Richards of the Rolling Stone, has an interview in this month's issue of Vogue where she talks about her bionic bladder. What does she mean by that? What is that?
In the history of developing methods for getting urine safely out of the body once the bladder is removed, there's been an evolution in the complexity of the things that surgeons can now do to make that happen. Once the bladder is removed, the goal is to get the urine from the kidneys and the ureters, those tubes that convey the urine normally down to the bladder, out into the outside world. The construction or the reconstruction that Patty Hansen's describing is called a neobladder. It is a segment of either small or large intestine that the surgeon takes during surgery and reconfigures by cutting and sewing into what is effectively a new container into which the ureters can be plugged. And then the neobladder can be attached to the urethra, permitting what is not entirely normal voiding, but effectively permits the individual to go about his or her life without the need for an external appliance, which was the traditional way of reconstructing individuals, sort of the urologic version of a colostomy.
Now, Sandra, I know that some people have said that bladder cancer is a very expensive cancer to treat and to live with. What was your experience?
I think that's right. I bladder cancer, because it's the most, the cancer of all human cancers most likely to recur. It recurs in the majority of patients. But you can live a long time with it, as Dr. Schoenberg explained, thankfully. But from an economic point of view, it means that this is a very expensive disease. And I think that alone gives us reason to really look at primary prevention. the billions of dollars spent every year treating bladder cancer patients and just following them. The amount of medical surveillance that's required is considerable, and I have a great outcome, and yet I can tell you I don't have a retirement account. Just keeping up with the premiums and the co-pays, and it's bladder cancer is one of those diseases. It's kind of like death by a thousand cuts because you're in and out of the doctor's office a lot. You're always waiting for the results back from the pathology lab, and there's always a bill that comes with each one of those.
Yeah, I'm sure that's really tough. You know, you talked about preventing bladder cancer. That'd be, of course, the best possible thing. Diane, tell us, do you know how your husband's bladder cancer developed or why?
No, I don't think you can ever know exactly why someone gets bladder cancer. John had smoked, but at the time he was diagnosed, he hadn't smoked for more than 20 years. But he had been a smoker. When he was in college, he worked around certain chemicals because he worked for the Parks Department, so used different solvents. So we're not exactly sure, but he did have several of the risk factors for the disease.
Well, now here's an email we've gotten from Karen, who writes, I had a non-cancerous bladder tumor removed when I was 27. It's been almost 9 years, and I've recovered well. Every doctor I've seen for treatment and follow-up has remarked about how unusual it is to have had a tumor in such a young woman and one who did not have a history of heavy smoking. Believe me, this is not a way one wants to be unique. Could you please ask your guest if my situation is actually that unique? Was some light smoking in college enough to lead to this problem? My only other risk factor is that I am a graphic designer and have some mild exposure to paints and aerosols. Dr. Schoenberg, what would you say to Karen?
This comes up from time to time, and it is an occurrence in my practice a couple of times a year that I'll meet someone who is quite young, someone in their 20s or 30s, newly diagnosed with a bladder cancer, and the question is, this is a disease of older people, why do I have this? And in an examination of this particular population using a complex set of genetic markers, my colleagues and I at Hopkins about a decade ago tried to figure out whether or not bladder cancers in younger people bear specific hallmarks that differentiate them from older patients. It turns out that they're exactly the same. It doesn't mean that we can necessarily explain the occurrence of these tumors, which may reflect an occult genetic or hereditary component that we just haven't elucidated yet. But thankfully, most of these younger patients also have typically non-invasive disease, and the majority of those individuals have a clinical course that mimics that observed in older patients, and which is thankfully usually pretty good.
Yes, go ahead, Diane.
I just wanted to add a comment. One of the reasons I think that bladder cancer has been largely ignored until Beacon got started 5 years ago is because it was seen as an old man's disease. And so, and an old man's disease, it might be a chronic disease, not a life-threatening one. But I can tell you for every person who has bladder cancer, every person I've met who has bladder cancer who's been a smoker, I can introduce you to somebody who never smoked. And for everyone who does have certain risk factors, I can introduce you to people who don't. And I think it's very important to get that message out there, that this is a disease that affects more than men over the age of 60.
And Sandra, I understand that men are much more likely to get bladder cancer, but that women are more likely to die from it. Why is that?
I don't think we know. I do think because the sense is that more men get it than women, perhaps women are not, don't go in as quickly. Perhaps they're not treated, the diagnosis is not as kind of aggressive with them. I would like to say, though, that, you know, that this is not a random problem. There are a lot of mysteries around bladder cancer, but yet there are a lot of patterns that we really need to be paying attention to. We know with certainty that arsenic exposure causes bladder cancer. We know that certain occupations, including hairdressers, have higher rates of bladder cancer. We know that certain coal tars cause bladder cancer. We know that soot, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, cause bladder cancer. So air pollution is also related. We know that certain kind of chlorinated compounds, such as water disinfection byproducts, are related to bladder cancer. And so these are patterns, I think, that we can begin to pay attention to and to take action on.
Well, for instance, you say hairdressers have a high incidence of it. Have there been steps taken to limit their exposure to the things that we know cause bladder cancer?
Not as much as there should be. And that's why I think groups like Diane's are so important, because I think that the presumption among the public is that when scientists, through careful study, find these discoveries, that there must be somebody somewhere in government who then takes action based on science. And that's not always the case. We can pile up huge amounts of scientific data for which nobody's acting on. And I think that's really the lesson out of the breast cancer movement. In the early 1990s, when women with breast cancer began to insist on looking at the causes of the disease and the possible relationships to environmental exposures, that they really redirected scientific research, and they made policy changes based on the scientific discoveries that already existed. And I think we could do the same with bladder cancer. I'm really interested in taking a proactive approach. So, for example, on the horizon now is this newish technology called hydrofracking for drilling shale gas for natural gas exposure. I'm terribly concerned about this. It involves shattering bedrock and filling it with chemical-laced water. Some of those chemicals we know are linked to bladder cancer, and some of the flowback water that comes out of those wells contain things like benzene, arsenic, formaldehyde, radiation, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are caused in the compressors and the many diesel truck trips that these wells require. So here on the horizon is a technology that we know inherently involves chemicals linked to bladder cancer. I'm interested in all my fellow bladder cancer patients and every urologist across the land speaking out really strongly to say, look, you know, our energy policy can't rely on carcinogens linked to the most expensive kind of cancer in our population.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls and reading your emails at drshow@wamu.org. Well, Dr. Schoenberg, if we address some of these environmental exposures, could we basically eliminate bladder cancer?
That's a wonderful question, and I think, as Susan has explained, this is a disease that is caused by a lot of different kinds of chemicals. And so the question becomes how to responsibly address this laundry list of potential exposures in a rational way that permits us to live our lives in the way that we find most fulfilling. I think it's a very complicated discussion. I think it's one, obviously, that does involve all the different groups that are not only around this table, but that are involved in legislation, in formulation of energy policy, in regulation of industrial hygiene. So, the answer is, can you get rid of occupationally and environmentally produced cancers? Well, you can probably make a lot of progress. But, for example, one area in which we've made a lot of progress, but certainly not perfect progress, is in cessation of tobacco use. Many young people in this country continue to either start smoking or continue smoking. We know that cigarette smoking, particularly at a threshold level of 15 cigarettes per more a day, markedly increases your risk of developing bladder cancer. So a simple place to start, for example, although I think it's very laudable to pursue a responsible formulation of energy policy, is for us to work as a society on the use of and abuse of tobacco, which is a major contributor to the disease burden that I personally encounter in the clinic. Let me just add one other thing that was said earlier or expand a little bit on this. One of the reasons it's believed, at least amongst urologists, why women may have a worse prognosis, diagnosis of bladder cancer is because women, in contrast to men, are accustomed to seeing blood come out of their bodies. This, it is believed, may result in a delay in seeking medical attention for what ultimately turns out to be hematuria. Whether that's true or not, I think it's very important to get the message out to female patients that if you see blood in your urine, do not assume it is related to your menstrual cycle. Seek medical attention and get that evaluated.
Diane, how do you...
I think that's right. Actually, I would love to underscore that. I was, in fact, experiencing blood in my urine by the time I was 16. And, it would come and go. That's the other thing about bladder cancer hematuria. It's episodic. And so you see it one day, and then if it goes away, it's easy to ignore. And for women, we are used to seeing blood at the bottom of the toilet. and I should have gone in much sooner than I did.
Diane, how do you go about starting an advocacy group? It seems like a huge task.
Well, you take it one step at a time because, yes, it is a huge task. We were very fortunate. Dr. Schoenberg played an instrumental role in helping us get Beacon off the ground. We always knew it would need to be a cooperative effort among the survivor community as well as the medical community. And so Dr. Schoenberg helped introduce John and me to bladder cancer specialists at a urology meeting, and we talked about our idea to put together this advocacy organization, and all of the doctors, there were about 18 or 20 in the room, each of them said, please do it. And we had the support from the medical community from the beginning. So we started small. We started with a website. I'm not sure this could have been done as quickly without being in the internet
age. And what is your web address?
Our web address is www.beaconbcan.org.
We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to go straight to the phones and take some of your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Gary Steingart's new novel is a romance set in a future New York City where America is in chaos. We're at war with Venezuela, corporations have merged beyond recognition, and armies of the poor have taken over Central Park. The book is called Super Sad True Love Story. Join us.
Arlene's been holding on the phone. She's calling us from Garden City, Michigan. Arlene, thanks for holding on.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I call because I was wondering about, from the time of exposure, how long after would someone become aware that there was a problem? The reason I'm calling is because my 75-year-old husband was diagnosed last December, and thankfully he had a wonderful physician, William Stuckey from St. George, Utah, and he said that after he did all of the necessary things to determine what the tumors showed, it had not penetrated the muscle wall. The reason I'm calling in terms of time of exposure to the time of finding the or getting the diagnosis, my husband was retired 16 years from an auto company where he handled chemicals. And I was wondering, could it be that long after exposure that he could have this?
Well, Arlene, interesting question. Dr. Schoenberg, what do you think?
Well, if you look at the literature on delay, or what's referred to as latency, from the time of exposure till the time of disease diagnosis, it's usually around 20 years, 25 years. So this fits, unfortunately, but I'm glad your husband's doing well, it fits into a very typical exposure latency that we would see for an individual exposed to something that would cause a bladder tumor.
Well, Arlene, we hope your husband does well. Here's an email from Mike, who writes us from Orlando. He says, I am a 53-year-old man, five-year survivor of stage 2 bladder cancer. He says, I always wondered how I got bladder cancer. In April of 2008, I got a letter from the military informing me of my exposure to trichloroethylenes and other dry cleaning fluids while in the Marines and stationed at Camp Lejeune. I have since found out I was also exposed to benzene at the same time. I had never smoked, ate well, exercised. I was exposed to chemicals that are known to cause this. Dr. Schoenberg, is that a story you've heard before?
Yes, and I'm sure Dr. Steingraber also will be able to elaborate on this also. These are the types of chemicals which we know in humans can predispose an increased risk of the development of bladder cancer, benzene, benzidine, orthotoluene. These types of chemicals and the chemicals unfortunately used in certain dry cleaning formulations are known to contribute to the development of this disease.
So, Sandra, what can people do to figure out if they might have been exposed to something that puts them at risk? I mean, if you're in the Marines, it doesn't really sound like a high-risk bladder cancer occupation in terms of exposure to chemicals, but maybe it is.
Well, indeed it is. And, in fact, members of the military are often exposed to chemicals, including certain kind of solvents, not only bladder carcinogens, but other things as well. And the President Cancer Panel, the most recent report from the President's Cancer Panel, in fact, identified members of the military as being at special risk for environmentally induced cancers. And in fact, Camp Lejeune is now becoming famous in the field of epidemiology for the high levels of waterborne solvents that Marines were exposed to. And breast cancer among male Marines is also elevated among that cohort, and there's an ongoing investigation. Tetrachloroethylene, also known as perchloroethylene, is the solvent that's used in dry cleaning fluids. It is a bladder carcinogen. That's the chemical that I discovered in my own hometown drinking water wells. It probably was used not so much in dry cleaning where I grew up, but it's also used in machine shops to degrease metal parts. So machinists who have exposure to cutting fluids are also exposed to perchloroethylene. And so I think that knowing these things, again, makes bladder cancer patients on the front lines of really demanding a transformation to a green economy. We know how to clean textiles and machined parts without needing to soak them in bladder carcinogens. So there's new technologies called wet cleaning for the non-toxic cleaning of textiles. And we're the ones that need to be demanding the transformation to these new green technologies on human rights grounds. It's wrong to give people bladder cancer in order to carry out things like cleaning clothes and cleaning industrial parts when we know there's better ways to do it.
Diane, I wonder, what would your advice be to someone who works at a dry cleaner or who is a hairdresser and is concerned that maybe they're being exposed to chemicals that are going to cause bladder cancer later on? What would you advise them to do?
Well, I'd advise them to go see their doctor, to start with their internist, to start with having a urine test done, just to make sure. Well, certainly if they see blood in their urine, to go see their doctor, but just to have regular checkups with their doctors, go to have that annual physical so that if anything does come up, it is caught early.
Let's talk to Ann. She's calling us from Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. Ann, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call. My comment was that my sister was diagnosed with bladder cancer at the age of 34. She went to her family physician after seeing blood in her urine and was treated, I think, 3 times for a urinary tract infection. This was over the course of about 8 months, and it eventually took a visit to the ER for her to be referred to a urologist. So I would like to say that for anybody experiencing this, just be very persistent with your physician if it's an ongoing issue and request more testing. I mean, she wishes that she had gotten the follow-up testing much, much sooner than she did.
We hope your sister's doing all right, Anne.
And
yeah, she's doing very well. Thank you.
And I would also like to say your sister's situation, unfortunately, is not unusual. Again, I think in part because bladder cancer had been considered a disease for men, that lots of time when women present with blood in their urine, they're often treated for a urinary tract infection. The blood goes away, and yet it's been the wrong diagnosis. And so that's been a problem continuously. So we hope that women understand that if they have blood in your urine, don't let the doctor just dismiss it as a urinary tract infection.
All right. And thanks for your call. Let's go to Elliot calling us from Myersville, Maryland. Elliot, hi. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for taking my call. I was just calling to point out that the Journal of National Cancer Institute had an article in June of 97, and it was basically titled The Carcinogenicity of Chlorinated Drinking Water. And the second cancer of the nine that they listed was bladder cancer, and it was from the chlorine byproducts, which was already mentioned as something to be aware of. But this is something that people are getting on a daily basis if they're in the municipal water supply with chlorine.
Well, Sandra, is this a problem? Is chlorinated drinking water associated with bladder cancer?
We do have good evidence to suggest that chlorinated drinking water byproducts are related to both bladder cancer as well as colon cancer. Probably the best work done on that was by a scientist for the National Cancer Institute, Ken Cantor, in Washington, D.C. And that's tricky because obviously we want our drinking water to be safe. We don't want it to be full of pathogens. But really, the choice should not be between, you know, cholera and bladder cancer. I know that in Europe, they've moved toward other forms of water disinfection using other technologies such as ultraviolet light or ozone exposure. So again, the high levels of bladder cancer and the expense of disease give us urgency around finding safer technologies. We've been throwing chlorine in drinking water to purify it since the 19th century. New Jersey was the first state to start that more than 100 years ago. Surely we need to move into the 21st century with drinking water. And that's true for other things, too. You know, I'm concerned about women hairdressers who have this high higher-than-expected rate of bladder cancer and bear high risks. Surely we can green our hairdressers. And in fact, I myself get my hair cut at an all-green hairdressing salon called the Savage Creek Salon in Varna, New York. And I think when we do have solutions for these problems, whether it's by wet cleaning our clothes instead of dry cleaning, by greening the hairdressing shop, or by figuring out how to better clean up our drinking water, we need to figure out ways of moving these solutions into the mainstream so they're not just sitting out there as an alternative. And this is where I think a really powerful bladder cancer advocacy could really move these solutions along.
And really something individuals could do in their own lives by choosing where they take their dry cleaning, for instance, or where they go to
exactly.
get their haircut. Dr. Schoenberg, we talked earlier in this hour about the fact that bladder cancer has had less advocacy surrounding it than, say, heart disease or breast cancer or AIDS. And I wonder, does that translate, do you think, into funding levels?
Absolutely. And to give Diane Qualley the well-deserved credit that she and both her husband, John, should receive, I think it's well known in the medical communities of this country, particularly in academic communities, that researchers are not the ones who really raise the cry and rally the public around a cause. It's patients and their families who are able to both identify and then be identified as leaders of these types of causes. And Diane has done a marvelous job of getting this going in the area of bladder cancer. One of the major problems we as researchers and clinicians who concentrate on this disease face is the fact that extramural national funding for research in bladder cancer is at a remarkably low rate. Diane actually is the one who showed me that as of the last statistics we were able to gather, the national funding level for bladder cancer research in the United States was hovering around $30 million, which pales in comparison to other funding efforts in other well-known disease areas such as lung, breast, and prostate cancer. What this practically translates into for your listeners and for patients and their families is that people like me, my colleagues, the researchers I work with, the basic scientists I rely upon, don't have the resources to make the type of progress that we would all like to see occur in this area. New diagnostics, more economical ways of taking care of the large group of individuals who carry a bladder cancer diagnosis and will be living, like Dr. Steingraber, with this disease for many years to come and who will require some form of care. Well done randomized clinical trials, innovative new technologies. All of this stuff costs money, and unfortunately in this area, the money is truly lacking, and it can't all come from philanthropy. So it's a great place to have someone like Diane and her colleagues at Beacon leading the charge to raise public awareness.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've been taking your calls. Here's a question we get from Facebook. Joanne asks us, is there anything one can do to prevent bladder cancer, like drink more water or drink less soda? Does that make any difference? Anybody on the panel? Diane?
Don't smoke.
Don't smoke. That'd be an important step. Sandra, is there anything else you can do? Does drinking more water or do any steps like that that seem to make a difference?
I'm not sure about the water consumption thing. I think there are two schools of thought on that. One is that you're making whatever kinds of exposures you might have, you're diluting them by drinking lots of water. On the other hand, if the source of the problem is the chlorinated byproducts in the water, then you're also running a lot more carcinogens through your bladder. I guess I would say to become a kind of environmental detective in your own community. Find out what's in your drinking water wells. Every single utility now has to report to you on a quarterly basis in your water bill what's found in drinking water. And we know that drinking water, whether it's by chlorination byproducts or other carcinogens, is linked to bladder cancer. I would find out what's in your consumer products, what's in your hairdresser salon, what goes on at your dry cleaning shop, and so forth. How is your electricity generated? Those are the kinds of things that I certainly look for. In living downstream, I advocate that we all become environmental detectives in our own community. Go in search of what I call our ecological roots.
Now, here's an email from Jeff who asks, could your guests address other conditions that might predispose an individual to bladder cancer? For instance, could truck driver's bladder increase someone's chances of acquiring the disease? We've gotten several emails about truck driver's bladder, which I don't have to admit, I don't actually know what that is. Dr. Schoenberg, what is it?
I think what it is that truck drivers, particularly long-haul drivers, obviously spend many hours in the cab, presumably exposed to some fumes from the engine of the truck, don't empty the bladder on a regular basis. And at least, I suppose, one contributing problem here is that if the urine that is contaminated by chemicals sits in the bladder longer, the bladder is more continuously exposed to potential carcinogens, presumably from combustion. Truck drivers, in fact, actually are in the laundry list of individuals who are potentially at greater risk than the baseline population for the development of bladder cancer. So, you know, there are many occupations that we believe, like hairdressers, may increase one's individual risk. What are the things one can do? Well, more frequent urination, possibly dilution with increased drinking. But, of course, there is the problem that if your work environment is contaminated and you can't get away from it, that may be the matter you really have to address.
You know, I thought from the number of emails that we must have a large truck driver contingent listening to the Diane Rehm Show, though I wonder how they're sending us emails. I'm a little concerned about that. Here's an email from Barbara who writes us, my husband was diagnosed with bladder cancer in January this year. It was suspected when there was microscopic blood in his annual physical urinalysis well before the blood was visible. Thus, he was at stage one and only needed immunotherapy, not chemotherapy, and his bladder is now clear. I can't strongly enough urge men and women to have an annual physical to catch this disease early when it's easily treatable. That seems like good news, doesn't it, Dr. Schoenberg? I mean, good news for him and good advice for the rest of us.
It's great news, but underneath that great news is a very complicated medical question. I'm going to try to, because I know we're running out of time, tell you just a couple of things about it. Hematuria, blood in the urine, often visibly apparent to the individual when a bladder tumor is bleeding, can occur in another form called microscopic hematuria. The urine looks clear, mm-hmm. but if examined under a microscope, more red blood cells than should be there are apparent to the examiner. The problem is that the vast majority of Americans who have microscopic hematuria never develop any sort of urinary tract cancer. And this creates a real tension and problem for internists upon whom the burden of examining all of this annual physical associated urine falls. It also produces a tremendous amount of unnecessary testing in the United States. In fact, our European colleagues...
Big issues we'll need to discuss on another Diane Rehm Show. I want to thank our panelists for being with us, and thanks to our listeners. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for being with us.